hello everyone and welcome along to Planet FM. I'm Alice Worsley and a very special guest for you to meet today. Her name is Pat Cavendish O'Neill, and chances are you've seen her on the television recently talking about her book A Lion in the Bedroom, and it is a bestseller, a fascinating look at some parts of Pat's life because she's a woman who is now in her 80th year now, and this book just covers part of her life and I can't wait for the other ones to come out. But I welcome her today. It's lovely to have you here, Pat, and I mean this literally, A Lion in the Bedroom, only goes up to what part of your life?
It goes up to when I left Kenya and I was about 40. I don't know. Don't ask me dates.
So you're in your 40s. So this is this book only goes back, about 30-odd years ago.
Yes.
So there's a whole new book to be written if you get time.
If I get time.
And that's the hardest thing for you, I would imagine, because if we just tell people where you live now and then we go back to see how you came to that, I think it'll be quite interesting to realize it's a very busy life you lead.
Yes, well, I have so many animals, you see. I rescue animals all the time. And so now I've got a chimpanzee, I've got all my baboons, which are brought up from tiny babies till they're, you know, and they think I'm mother. And I've got all the dogs. We've got 32 actually in the house.
Right.
I've got 15 that sleep on the bed with two cats. And when the baboons are growing up, they also sleep on the bed with bottles and nappy changes and everything. And then I've got donkeys, pigs, goats, all sorts of other monkeys, lots of birds. And as I keep telling everybody, which fills them with horror, lots of mice, because I rescue mice from the cats. So I've got over 100 mice, which I keep in another special sort of enclosure, you know, where they get fed every day.
So that must...
So they multiply.
They do. Well, I did actually train many years ago as what they call an animal technician, and I used to be in a breeding unit for mice, and if you need me to come over and tell you which is mum and which is dad so that we can separate them, I'm very good at that.
It looks like if I need it.
So this would take... obviously a lot of your time, but also a lot of your money, because that's what I would imagine, a lot of money on a day-to-day basis to keep these animals fed in a way that is close to their own diet.
Yes, because enormous amount of food I get, but there's the shop where I shop, I won't shop anywhere else, it's a big supermarket, and they give me what's called all their waste, which is a big help, because as circumstances happened, and lovely accountants, I haven't got any money that I had. I mean, most of the fortune is, well, practically all of it's gone now. And so this is why I've sold off most of the farm. I've still got 28 hectares, but before it was an enormous farm and two farms, and where I had 300 horses, you know, because I used to train for my mother. But now I haven't got any of that today, but just to keep these animals is a vast expense. So every penny I've got now goes on the animals. And it's too sweet. I have to tell you a very sweet story. Because I've got a lovely lot of African staff who've been with me for years. And they know I don't spend money on themselves. So when I'm coming to Australia, they've all got very worried. And too sweet. The petticoat I've got on today was given me by one maid. And another one's given me my bedroom slippers. They clubbed together to give me two jerseys. So they wanted me to arrive.
Isn't that lovely?
Don't you think? It's so sweet,
you know. Yes.
And when you think, I priced the price of the petticoat, it was one quarter of her weekly wage that she just spent on my petticoat alone.
But that is obviously how much they love you.
You to tears, you know. Yeah.
And when you think about it, Pat, too, it's very interesting. There are your genuine people who love you and are loyal to you. And as you were just saying, you had a big fortune at one stage of your life.
Yes.
And you have people like some of the trusty accountants that you thought were who literally ripped you off of all your money.
That's right.
So
exactly.
Who are the better people?
I know. And then, of course, two great friends finished it off.
But oh.
Well, they did. You know, they took out a... only last year, they took out on the farm, a bond on the farm, because they explained he had a marvellous business and making all these frames, and all he needed the money up front, but he didn't tell me he was actually trading in bankruptcy. So he took out a bond on my farm, which I willingly signed at the bank, because they were great friends. And 4 months later, they were in bankrupt. And the, actually, the bank would have taken over the farm. And then another, but here a great friend came to my rescue.
Yes.
And a very, very big horse breeder called Graham Beck. He owns all the coal in Kenya. South Africa, he's one of the richest men in South Africa, but he's also enormous in horse breeding, owns Gainsway, stud in America and everything. And he paid off the bank.
Mm.
So you see what one person steals from you.
Yeah, another gives you back. Yeah. Now, is it true that your will is such that it's all goes, what is left, obviously, when you do go to that great big... what should we call
the
it?
Joint mummy tana.
Yes, in the sky. Your will states that all your animals will be looked after, and your husband doesn't get anything. Is that right? Can you just quickly explain to us why you did that too?
Well, my husband's 1 year younger than myself. There is, on the farm, there's still quite a large amount of houses, which I rent at the moment. But I've left one to him for his lifetime. But the farm, as is, remains for the chimpanzee and the baboons, because the chimpanzee can live for 60 years, the baboon can live for another 40 years. My chimpanzee is about 20 now, but she's still got another 40 years, you know, and I've got no children.
No.
So I have to guarantee that their safety
and well-being.
And well-being.
Yeah. So let's go back then, because this is fascinating. You have this most wonderful place now and all your wonderful animals, but it all began with a very outgoing mother.
Yes.
Tell us about Enid, your mother, because she was connected to the famous wine family in Australia, the Lindemans.
Yes, and she was supposedly one of the six most beautiful women in the world. I mean, that's the newspapers. I mean, and she was. She was unbelievably beautiful, because her hair went silver at the age of 28. So that was amazing. She's 5'11", had the most wonderful figure, and enormous green eyes. So it was striking, you know, and then she had this extraordinary, I mean, everything.
Mm.
And men, amazing men, just seemed to love her till they died. I mean, I think one of the funniest stories is General Erskine. Was, I think, one of the, in the time of my father's, when my father was commanding officer at Aldershot. And he loved Mummy forever, obviously. And just when my mother's very ill, Mrs. Erskine called me up and said, "Where are you going to bury your mother?" So I said, No, I'm not, I mean, my mother's not that ill. "No, no," she said, "Pat, you must make up your mind." She said, "My husband wants to be married next to her, and I'm not prepared to keep digging him up." Which I thought was lovely. "I'm not prepared to keep digging him up."
So, I mean, she had that way with men, didn't she?
Yes,
And also, she married how many times in total?
She was married 4 times.
Now, 2 of those were to millionaires.
Yes, her first husband.
Yes. But was he your father?
No, her second husband was Cavendish, general. He was the youngest general in the English army.
Right.
And but he was a colonel when my mother married him, and he was very dashing, and a 10-goal polo player, and he only had his army pay, but of course Mummy outfitted him to that.
Yes, because she'd had that previous money from the first marriage.
Yes, and after all, from her own family, she wasn't that poor either, you know. Because her grandfather started the wine in Australia with the Hunter Valley. He came out from England and then started the wine. He was the first person to plant wine in Australia. It was Lindemann wine.
Right.
And she was very, very close to her family.
Yes.
And and actually one boyfriend, funnily enough, I remember when I landed here, was an ex-governor of New Zealand.
Oh.
But Lord Norrie.
Right.
And I was looking him up. He was governor in 1955.
Governor General, that would that be?
Yes, Governor General.
Right.
And because I remember he also was a great admirer of hers for a long time. I mean, yes. this went back to when they were very young,
yes.
You know. when he was in the army as well.
Yeah.
And
after your father, who was in the army, your mother remarried two more times. In fact, Somerset Maugham started to notice that she was going through husbands like hot dinners. Now, tell us a little bit about...
Well, actually, what happened is that Willie Maugham stuttered very badly. And he was... Her name was Lady Kenmare, because her last husband was Viscount Castlereagh, Earl of Kenmare. And he owned all the lakes of Killarney. He was the biggest landowner in Ireland, but had no mother. He was what they call a bon viveur. He overdrank,
yes,
overate, and gambled all the money away. Somerset Maugham was a great friend of my mother, and he was introducing her, and he was touching Lady K-K-K-K, and Mum said, come on, Willie, just call me Lady Kilmore, and that's how that actually
think
came.
I wanted
Lady K-K-K-K. That's how that came about.
So you really, growing up, the second husband was your father. You already, your mother had this most amazing variety of friends. What are some of your memories as a child of the people that used to come and go in your house, or that you as a family would go to visit, who were literally famous people of the world?
Yes, well, when I was very young, when we lived with my stepfather Furness, I was too young to, and I saw them more or less on the outskirts,
yes,
because we weren't allowed into the front of the house. We were kept to our own part of the house. We had our own staircase, our own staff. And we were only allowed in the front of the house twice a day, you know, to go and spend the morning with Mummy.
Yes.
When nobody else was around,
you know. This was in England still?
This was in England.
Sense. Right, yeah.
But it was after the war in the south of France, because Mummy had a huge circle of friends, and my brother equally, that I used to sort of sit as a young girl in her 20s, you know, and not be part of it, but listen to, yes, all these ladies gossiping about their lovers or their husbands, and they were all very famous. And it was, so I've written a lot about it because you learnt the most amazing details.
Yes. So give us a few names of the people who your mother used to know, who used to visit, or that she would see.
For instance, she knew most, I think, one of the funniest, because he's so well known, was the Duke of Windsor.
Yes.
Because he had always been a great friend of my mother's. And he came with... My mother didn't approve of the Duchess at all, because she felt that the Duchess had behaved extremely badly. As she said, if a man gives up his throne for you, you don't then go and take lovers and parade them under your nose, more or less. And she'd come with her lover at that time, who's called Jimmy Goldsmith. One of my mother's greatest friends was Barbara Hutton, who's the Woolworth heiress.
That's right.
And she was a lovely person. I adored her also. She's a wonderful, wonderful person. And Jimmy Goldsmith was her cousin, and he's a horrid, horrid little man. And he was the lover of the Duchess. And downstairs at this lunch, after lunch, the Duchess got up and said, I must go and show Jimmy all the wonderful views. So she disappeared, and it took an awful long time to show Jimmy the wonderful views. So everybody realized what was going on, and now they had to keep him talking. So he didn't get too... And he was down to a sort of saying, when I was emperor, and everybody kept wanting to know all about when he was emperor, and keeping the conversation going as long as possible.
Meantime, the Duchess was upstairs showing Jimmy the views.
Yeah, showing Jimmy the views. That was one of the things I always remember, because everybody was sort of practically looking at their watches like this, wondering how much longer do we have to keep him talking.
I mean, your life is full of the most wondrous stories like that. And as you were just talking there about the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, we've mentioned Somerset Maugham. And there were times too when Princess Grace of Monaco, that was when your mother moved to France, was it?
Was all in France.
All in France at this stage, right?
All in the south of France.
Right. So you had dealings with Princess Grace as well?
Yes, she was a great, great friend of my brother, so we saw a lot of her, and Prince Rainier, and Prince Pierre de Polignac was one of my mother's great, great friends, and he was Prince Rainier's father, and he used to come over practically every day, I would say. And, well, there was everybody. There was Ian Fleming and the James Bond also.
Yes.
I mean the Mosleys. I don't know if you know the Mitfords, because she was one of the Mitfords.
Yes, yes.
There was Greta Garbo. There was, you name it, practically
Fred Astaire, every film star. I think I saw
every film star. The one I didn't like particularly was Frank Sinatra. He was very arrogant, and you know, he sort of used to strut up the front doorstep, you know, because there's a huge depth, and he used to strut up there as if to say, "Gosh, you know, I'm Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, here I am, everybody.
Here I am, everybody."
Yes, yeah.
You know, those kind of things you notice. Greta Garbo was lovely.
Yes.
Because she used to come and sit on the floor with us. And she used to have us in hysterics because she used to imitate people beautifully. And, you know, we were, myself, my brother, and one or two friends. And she felt more sort of happy with the younger sort of crowd who weren't, you know. And she used to do great imitations of my older brother, Rory Cameron, who was a famous, you know, he was famous for his garden designs and everything like that. And she did a wonderful imitation of him that she used to do of him designing his garden, and she used to plod around with her arms behind her back, peering at every sort of thing. It was quite hysterical.
Very entertaining.
Yeah.
Mm. So tell us when that all changed for you, when along came your lion.
Yes, well,
your little
you
lion
see,
club. When did that? Did your family move to Kenya at that stage?
No. What happened is that I went to Kenya when I was 10 years old, and I just, it remained like an absolute dream in my memory. And my brother was 9 at the time when we did that wonderful voyage to Kenya. And both of us fell in love. And he went back to Kenya after the war, and my mother bought him a beautiful farm. And as we were a very close family, we used to go out and stay with him every year. And my mother built a house on his farm where we spent 3 months a year. And it was on one of these visits that I was given this lion cub.
And it was a very small lion cub.
Oh, it fitted in the palm of my hand. It was tiny little.
Had it been abandoned, or what?
No, the mother had been shot.
Right.
And it was down. It was shot down on the Tana River, so I called it Tana. And so now I couldn't go home to France with Mummy.
Yes.
So Mummy bought me a farm, actually on the game reserve, at Carron, overlooking a beautiful reserve. And so that's where I then lived with my lioness. And from being a tiny little kitten, she grew into a huge lion. And she still slept on my bed every night. And, you know, it was that lovely puffy breath in your ear. You know, it was extraordinary. Because she's huge.
The smell of... What did you feed her?
I used to feed her is 30 kilograms of meat a day in milk.
Oh, okay.
Mm. And what I did so she'd never become possessive of her food was I always used to keep my hand in it or my foot in it or whatever, you know. And I remember one time I was rushing to the telephone and I dragged her food with me because she was in the middle of eating. So I put my, I didn't have shoes on, I put my foot into the basin and I wasn't paying attention. And Tyler thought my toe was a piece of meat. And the next thing, I just felt this sort of thing on my toe and I said, ouch, like this, and Tana immediately leapt away because as the blood came, she thought, oh, no, I've done something terrible. You know, she was so ashamed of herself.
So tell me about that bond, because so often you hear of people who form bonds with animals of the wild, who at some stage the animal changes and turns on them. This never happened with you, did it?
No.
I'm thinking of people like, you know, Siegfried and Roy with those tigers, where just suddenly in one of the shows that they did in Las Vegas, one of the tigers, something happened and it just about killed one of the
tigers. Yes, but that is slightly different.
Yeah.
Because these are trained tigers.
Yes.
And you don't have the same bonding. I mean, this lion was part of me. I mean, she was, as far as she knew, she was my child.
You were her mother, yes.
And later on, she took over the role of mother. This is how she saw me. I mean, something to be protected. And she looked after me like her. Well, to the most amazing degree. Because you see, a wild animal can pick up your thoughts. If I was terribly upset, for instance, she would know it immediately. She'd come and lie beside me and put her huge arm over me, and I'd be able to lie and cuddle her and sort of cry into her neck, you know, things like that. Well, she knew, you know.
Yeah.
This is why with wild animals, you mustn't be an emotional person, you know. And as I was brought up, never to know jealousy or anything like that. She just knew that I loved her, you see. Mm. And she did everything she could to return this. That's why she was able to save my life twice. You know, she
tell us quickly about once how she tried to save your life.
Well, I'll tell you another time. She saved my life from the Mau Mau by warning me an hour before they arrived. But another time, we used to walk together all over Africa. And I was up in the Mara, in the Maasai Mara, which is very beautiful. The river there, it was sunset. And normally, one is a bit careful when you're walking with my Lana. You know, used to watch out because there are snakes and everything. But the sun was setting and the hippo were bright red, the river was bright red, and I was absolutely... And you're up at quite a high altitude, and it's wonderful country. And I was carried away by the beauty of everything, so I wasn't paying too much attention. And Lana, very lazy. So Tana was always in not another walk sort of thing,
yeah.
And dragging herself along behind, you know, as if the end of the world had come. And it was, I approached a huge marshy area, and as I say, I wasn't paying attention at all. The next thing, she flew up, hit me to the ground, and I ended up lying on my back with the water, all muddy water, trickling down my neck. And she lay on top of me, and her ears were pricked, and she was absolutely still. Her
yes.
her paws were on my chest, and she just kept me pinned to the ground, and she was just looking like that. And I tried to turn my head to try and see what it was. You know, I knew something, you know. Yes. And then I heard all this sucking noise of feet being poured. She, I was just about to walk into a whole herd of buffalo. And if she hadn't realized... Now, how did she know
yes.
that I was too stupid not to realize the danger of what I was getting into, you know?
Yes.
Again, her so instinct of this stupid mother, or stupid child as I was by now, because she was a huge lioness, you know, that needed protecting.
Yeah. Very quickly, because we're just about at the end of the show, did she ever have cubs of her own?
Yes, she did.
And did she have them within your home? Like, did you...
Well, I took her right down to the northeast frontier of Kenya, where I lived on the compass point with her, because she was always coming in season every 8 weeks up at Kara, and a farmer said he'd shoot her if she came through his farm. And she was totally free. She was never, ever tied up, locked up, or any
anything.
Other kind of imprisonment of any kind. So I took her down there, and she ended up finding her own husband and having cubs, and I lived with her down there for 4 years.
Did you get to meet hubby?
Did she introduce him
and say,
well, yes,
Mum, I'd like you to meet my new man?
But he was a wild lion.
Yeah, so you literally had no communication with him.
Well, I mean, I see them every day,
yes,
you know,
yeah.
And I used to make sure they got food and...
Yeah.
I was spoiled, which I wasn't supposed to do, but, you know, my beloved wasn't. And she used to do, as soon as she heard my car approaching she used to jump onto the bonnet of the car, you see, and then I used to take her for a little ride.
Yes, she loved
then
that.
Then she used to just climb and give me a tremendous sort of embrace and lick, and then go back, jump back, and go back to her cubs.
That's incredible. Mm. And, of course, it's all here in the book, which is absolutely wonderful. And I could have talked to you if you'd had another 5 hours. We wouldn't have even touched the surface of your wonderful life, Pat. And I thank you so much for joining me today. And I hope maybe you'll come back again, and I certainly hope that maybe you'll find the time to write the rest of the book so that we get to know what happened next. And we wish you a safe journey back to all your wonderful animals in South Africa as well. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
And my special guest has been Pat Cavendish O'Neill. The book is called A Lion in the Bedroom, The Fabulous High Life of the Heiress Who Couldn't Say No to a Lion in the Bedroom. It is fantastic. It's available in all bookstores right now, and it is only $29.95. It's full of the most amazing photos and the wonderful stories of Pat Cavendish O'Neill. So check it out at a bookstore near you, A Lion in the Bedroom by Pat Cavendish O'Neill.